afternoon and over us into the overnight hours and into Saturday morning, but we're expecting to see not much accumulation, an inch or less across most parts of the state. Forecast for the rest of today calls for the clouds to increase this afternoon. We'll see a high of 11 degrees above zero, west winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour. It won't be dropping too much as far as the temperature goes tonight. Light snow is likely, not as cold, near steady temperatures, little or no accumulation, temperature of around 9 tonight for the low light south winds, up to 23 for tomorrow, a chance of snow in the morning, but still mostly cloudy throughout the day. Southwest winds tomorrow at 5 to 10. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low of 10 degrees. Sunday, cloudy at a high of 22. And clouds will stick around through most of next week with another chance of snow moving in Monday and Monday night. Actually, as early as Sunday night. And temperatures will be in the mid-20s for highs throughout the week. Lows Sunday night in the mid-teens, Monday through Wednesday nights in the upper teens. Right now, we are seeing single digits. Everybody is above zero, but not much above zero, as low as one above still in Mattoon. In Springfield, it's three above. Danville and Rantoul both reporting four. Two in Paris, four in Lincoln, and four in Bloomington. Pontiac, sunny in five, cloudy in three in Decatur. It is two above at Willard Airport. Sky is mostly sunny. We have a wind from the west at 5 miles an hour, so the wind chill is minus 8. Dew point at minus 5, relative humidity 72%, and the barometer is high and steady at 30.15. Right now, on Friends Plaza in Urbana, on the U of I campus, it is 8 degrees above zero.
Hi, Rich Warren here to let you know about a midnight special pledge event on January 22nd. I'll be playing your folk favorites and offering tickets to a dinner and intimate concert with folk singer Deborah Cowan. That's the Midnight Special, January 22nd on AM 580.
It's 12:39 on the Afternoon Magazine. Champaign's Art Theater is bringing real life to the screen for the next week. Stories for its first documentary festival in the next week include the study of a popular comedian, the well-profiled downfall of a former New York governor, and a look at failings in the American education system. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert talked with the theater manager at the Art, Sanford Hess, who says showing those films is a simple matter of downloading them in the same way the Art has been offering opera and ballet performances.
They're a service. They work with theaters, so I can rent the films through them in a way that I wouldn't be able to do otherwise, and I can show them one time, and it's viable because it's all digital. We would never be able to do this in the 35-millimeter print world, because the shipping and putting together the films would make it way too complex to do 10 different movies like this. In this case, it was a combination of a couple things. One was the ability to do it. The second was they announced an Oscar shortlist, which I didn't know they had before this year, but they do. So they sort of pre-announced the likely nominees. And in this case, they had released it, and I got an email from the service that I use and said, hey, you know, we carry, you know, 2/3 of the documentaries on the shortlist. Showing a documentary for a full week is kind of tough for us because documentaries don't usually draw as well as a dramatic film. So if we show a documentary for a week, our business is not going to be as good. And we can do a week and we can show them like this and it makes sense for us and it's a great opportunity to bring them all together. And plus, of course, you get some good energy by combining them all together that it becomes sort of this event. And that was a really positive thing too.
The digital service, you're not bringing in the films. They're literally in a very high-tech form, kind of like downloading them. Is that the proper word?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's not too different from like an iTunes in a way. You know, the one difference is that it's our server, that we have a local computer, is controlled by them remotely, and they push the movies down to us. It's not like I have to go online and download them or anything. So they push them down, but then from once they're down locally, we use sort of a simple interface to just play them through this, and then they go really high quality out to the projector.
So these were all on the short list?
Not all of them.
How did you go about choosing what movies you were going to show?
Well, a lot of it was related to, I mean, most of them were the ones on the short list. The other ones were a few that were recommended. You know, an example of that, like Last Train Home was not on the short list, but was really highly recommended. As Joan Rivers, that's more of a situation where it wasn't on the short list, but I knew it would be really a fun movie to show and popular. A couple of those were ones where people asked us early in the year to show them, you know, Joan Rivers being a good example of this. We had a couple of different patrons ask us to show it. And we looked into it a few times, but scheduling, it just never sort of seemed the right time to book it. So we're happy to bring it in now. Two or three other ones actually were situations where I had been contacted directly by the filmmakers. The late night movie that we're showing is a documentary about a band. The band is the Drive-By Truckers. So they contacted us directly about showing that film, and it just kind of worked well with moving into the schedule. Similarly, The Desert of Forbidden Art was one that we've been talking to them about showing. I mean, the film is an interesting film, and it's gotten a lot of great feedback. It's just not very well known.
Yeah, tell me more about that one.
It's a good story. It was under the Soviet Russia in the 60s and 70s. A number of different artists' work were banned by the government. So there was one man out in a relatively remote area who, he was an artist himself, and he collected some of these pieces into a local museum and just sort of managed to stay under the radar. And with the fall of Soviet Russia, all of a sudden here was this guy has this fabulous museum of all kinds of works of art that you can't see anywhere else because the work was banned and in many cases destroyed. You know, it's an example of a good documentary because it works on more than one level. It's about the facts of the story, but it's also about the human story beyond that and this one man and his efforts to do this.
The one that jumps out for me that I'm really intrigued about is A Film Unfinished, this piece of Nazi propaganda, I think would probably be the easiest way to explain it.
And the word is unfinished. I mean, the Nazis went in 1942. They went into Warsaw, into the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw, and they filmed life in the ghetto. And there's different theories about what they really were going to do with it as propaganda. One interesting thing about it is they had shot, I think it was about an hour of footage. So they had shot this footage, and it was found soon after the war in World War II. Then much, much later, they found additional footage. And the additional footage that they found was alternate takes and edited scenes and things like that. And they were able to realize from putting the two together that some of the scenes from the first reel had actually been staged because they showed them rehearsing it or trying it again and things like that. So it brought a whole new level of meaning to it. And the movie that we're showing is a lot of it is the footage. At the same time, it's some analysis of what they were trying to do with the footage. But even more importantly, it works as a historical artifact because that was a society that was wiped away within a year or two of when it was filmed and doesn't exist. So here is an incredible historical artifact of what, you know, at least a snapshot of what life was like, you know, even during World War II, you know, let alone in the years up to it.
Any other ones you want to point to our attention? You mentioned Last Train Home.
Last Train Home. It's again a good human story. It's about workers in China, and it focuses on one family. And the filmmaker stayed with his family and worked with them for a couple of years, actually. Like many families in China, in this case, both of the parents migrate from their home in more rural areas to the cities where they work most of the year. And at the New Year, which is the major holiday time, there is this, as they call it in the film, the largest migration on Earth occurs of people out of the cities and back to the rural communities. So it takes that trip with this family and takes us on that trip. At the same time that it's this incredible human story, it's also beautifully shot, and the landscapes and the visuals are stunning. And as many of the reviews that you'll read that make note of the story also talk about the beauty of the film itself. Most of them screen twice. One of them, the Glenn Gould documentary and the William Kunstler documentaries, each screen once, as does Queen of the Sun. Queen of the Sun, by the way, that's going to be our Thursday night show. That was another movie that was this was a little different how it got to the festival. We have worked with Common Ground on a screening before, and in this case, sort of a just a coincidence that we're talking to them, and they mentioned this film, which is about the honeybee population and sort of an upcoming environmental disaster due to genetic changes that we have caused in the honeybee population. They had talked to us about this film, and at the same time, I got contacted by my buyer, my film buyer, who was a person I work with. She arranges the films for me. She independently contact me about the same film and said, hey, this is a great film, and it's a small, you know, it's a very small release, but it's available and you should look into it. So, you know, hearing about it from two different avenues like that, it was an easy decision to include it. And actually Common Ground is going to arrange for a local speaker to talk about the impacts in the film. And I'll say this again, the film, as with many good documentaries, not just is it about the facts of this impending environmental disaster, it's also a little more lighthearted look at some of the people who are in beekeeping. You know, a number of the people that they profile are sort of people who have you cannot imagine them in any other business except what they're doing, and they have interesting philosophies on why and how they do what they do. So it's a profile of them as much as it's about the facts of the honeybee population.
I would expect with every screening you'll have your little pre-film brief lecture, explain what this is about and that kind of thing, as we've come to expect now.
We'll try. Hopefully, you know, the one challenge we might face, some of the screenings are pretty tightly scheduled. Okay. So we did that to sort of get as much as we could on the screen as possible. But we will, you know, we'll be trying to bring out a couple key points about each of these. And we'll also, of course, we always have the pre-show slides that we try to convey some more information through.
Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bosser talked with Sanford Hess. He's the manager of Champaign's Art Theater about its documentary festival. It begins tonight and runs through next Thursday at the theater on West Church Street. You can find a full schedule online. Their website is thecuart.com. That's three W's dot thecuart, all one word, .com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Lunch is also served on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30 and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 21st of January, 2011. It was on this day, 1926, a 33-year-old novelist named Vida Sackville-West wrote an impassioned love letter to the novelist Virginia Woolf, who was 10 years older. Vida had been married for more than a decade. She loved her husband. She was attracted to women as well, all of which was also true of Virginia Woolf. They'd met through the Bloomsbury Group, a group of people who gathered to talk about literature and art and philosophy. And they cautiously began a romance. But by 1926, when Vida wrote this letter, she was deeply smitten. She wrote from Italy, where she was riding a train.